That was quick. My name's David Duncan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
everybody. Billy, thank you for asking me to come down and share. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's January 24th, 1989. For that, I'm truly grateful. I don't claim any credit for it whatsoever. I honestly, all it really means is I have now officially been a sober member of AA 20 and a half years longer than I meant to be. I did not show up here and sign up, ask for the 21-year program. I was looking more for like the 6 months and let me get my stuff together and thank you very much kind of program. As a matter of fact, when I got here, 6 months tops was what I was going to give this thing. So I don't believe that the fact that I'm still here can in any way be accredited to me. It was not my plan. I also have a home group. It's Hope Is Here in Old Town Alexandria up in Northern Virginia every Tuesday night at 8:30, standard drunk time. It's a closed meeting. If you're an alcoholic or you get a problem with booze, come see us anytime. It's open on anniversaries. Anybody can come. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other men. I had to wear the Kermit tie today for a couple of reasons. Number one, because I only own three suits, and only one of them actually fits right now, and that's the black one. And I also wear my Kermit tie to remind myself how spiritual I am, because my mother-in-law gave it to me. And there's a reason she gave it to me. When I was about 5 years sober, a good friend of mine in Richmond asked me to speak at a speaker's meeting, and I guess I had spoken maybe once before or twice before, but hadn't really done it very much. And, you know, they say that when you speak, there's three stories you tell. There's the one you're going to tell, the one you tell, and the one you wish you told. So I was going to get it right this time, so I started to write out, you know, all the funny things that I always forgot to say and that I meant to say and all the spiritual stories and axioms and everything. It was a beautiful thing. And the guy who sponsored me at the time, a guy named Matt, I called him and said, I'm going to go speak. I need to do some inventory, do some house cleaning first, which, you know, I was like doing spiritual actions so that I could sound better from the podium. I know there's a flaw in that thinking somewhere, but I just haven't nailed it yet. But anyway, I did a little inventory, and I called him and said, you know, come over and listen to it, and I'm reading him all this stuff that I wrote down, and he's actually got a piece of paper, and he's writing some things down, and I didn't know it until we were finished, but I found out later he was writing my 8-step list. And so he's listening to all this, and I told him I was going to talk, but that's all I told him. I'd been invited to talk at this meeting, and at the end of that, he hands me the piece of paper, and I go, okay, okay, oh, God, all right, okay, okay, okay. And at the bottom, he wrote, forget the speech. And, of course, me, being the humble alcoholic that I am, looked at him and said, but it's so good. And he said, I know. He said, I know it is. He said, but here's what happens. When you speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, hopefully what happens is, you're like Kermit the Frog, and God is Jim Henson. And hopefully God is going to stick his hand up in you, and he's going to do the talking. And all you are is the puppet. You know, my sponsor is always fond of telling me now today when I got to go do a commitment. He says, just remember, Dave, you ain't today's news. You're just the paper boy. That's all you are. You're just delivering the message. He puts me right where I'm supposed to be. But he said, when you write things down, you starch the frog. He said, don't starch the frog. And so I didn't. I threw it away, and I've never written anything down. Maybe when I've done a traditions workshop or on the history or something like that, I've written a couple of notes, but never for my own personal story. So whatever you get today, that's what you get. I don't know what it is, but that's what you get. Because the way I've been taught and the way that we do this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is we do it from the heart. We do it for fun and for free, and we do it from the heart. So I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, regular, standard family. The only thing dysfunctional about my family was me. I have two older brothers. They've done very well, seem to be fine. Two of the best parents in the world, had everything I ever needed, almost everything I ever wanted. Only problem was I always wanted more. That seems to be a theme in my life. You know, but just a regular childhood, you know, and when I was 15, I'd get straight to the drinking. I always think, you know, I always think drinking deserves at least an honorable mention in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, sometimes I go and we talk a lot about the solution, but we don't talk about drinking. You know, it has something to do with why we're all here, you know. When I was, some people some people, come from various backgrounds, come from alcoholic families, come from split families, or military families, all that kind of thing. Lots of things that, I could point to say, this is why I'm an alcoholic. I don't have any of that. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm the drunk in my family. No, there is no other alcoholics in my family. The only reason, if there is any, that I figured out why I'm an alcoholic is I love booze. I love it. I just love it. From the first time that I got drunk, at my friend Mike DeWop's house with Bacardi 151 and Country Time lemonade mix, mixed up in a Tupperware bowl, I love that. I love champagne. I love moose heads. I love Lowenbrows. I love Coors Light. I loved Warm Schaefer Light. I loved Southern Comfort. I loved vodka. I loved Grain Shots. I loved Mad Dog 2020. I loved Thunderbird. I love wine coolers in a can, and yes, they make them in a can. And I didn't start out there. There was a time when I could turn my nose up at certain stuff, but you just push right through that. You just push right through that, and you get down to what works, And there came a time when I wouldn't turn my nose up at anything, and I did whatever it took to get the job done, and I just loved booze. I loved it. Like I said, my first drunk was when I was 15 years old at my buddy Mike DeWop's house. Country Time lemonade mix and a Tupperware bowl, and we started passing that thing around, and that's when it happened. It just got around to me enough times. And I didn't take my first drink because I was an alcoholic. I took my first drink because I was over at my buddy's house, and that's what they were doing, and I wanted to be cool, and I wanted to be like them. And honestly, I wanted to know what all the hubbub was about, because I grew up going to church, youth council, youth drama, youth choir, youth group, royal ambassadors, all this kind of stuff. And there was no booze in our house. It wasn't that I never even remember any discussions about alcohol or drugs at all. We just never had it in the house. We just didn't serve it. You came to our house, it was coffee, tea, soda, water, milk. And there was no, because we don't drink in this house, or the evils of alcohol or anything like that, it just wasn't there. But it looked to me like these other kids that were drinking, they looked like they were having a lot of fun. So I want to see what all the hubbub was about. When I got enough of that stuff in me, it happened to me. If you're an alcoholic here tonight, you know what I mean. It happened to me, I got that warm, fuzzy feeling from the tips of my toes to the top of my head. And I knew release from care, boredom, and worry for the first time in my life, It was just like, I felt like I was missing something. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know where to find it, and I couldn't tell you what it was, and I wouldn't tell you what it was because I didn't want you to know that I was missing it, But I was always felt like I was supposed to be somewhere and I was supposed to be doing something, but I didn't know where that was and I didn't know what that was. I just knew that I wasn't in the right place and I wasn't doing the right thing. And that leads to a lot of anxiety, especially when you don't have any answers for that stuff and you can't tell anybody that stuff. All that left. My friend Rich has a way of describing it. He says it's like the clock stopped. It just stopped ticking. And I was okay, As a matter of fact, I didn't know that I felt bad until I felt that good, But I'm sitting here drinking this stuff and feeling this way and thinking, wow, I felt really bad because this feels really good. No drama, no police, no consequences, nothing bad happened that night. The only thing I know now in retrospect that happened that night was something got branded on my brain. The thing that got branded on my brain that night was, this works. This stuff works. And you know what? Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I don't know where the invisible line was. I don't know if it was that night or the next night or the next night or the next night. But I know that I got that brand on my brain. And it doesn't matter if I stay sober 1,000 years. A brand does not come off. And that brand will never leave my brain. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. In my mind, left to my own devices, left to me to figure out how to keep me sober and get me sober, my mind is like MapQuest. It will find the quickest route from wherever I am to a drink with no stops in between. And it always will, because I am an alcoholic and it will always do that. That's where my mind gets me, left to my own devices. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, anyway, I drank as much and as long as I could. This was kind of sums up my drinking. There was an old-timer from Virginia who used to say, when I started drinking, I had this much fun, and I had this much trouble. And when I finished drinking, I had this much trouble, and I had this much fun, you know? My drinking kind of went like this. At first I drank to feel good, and booze made me feel good. It was great. It was fun. It was exciting. It did exactly what I wanted it to do. It made me feel incredible, you know? And then, as I began to lie and manipulate and get consequences and get in trouble, betray trust, you know, do the things that we do when we need to do what we do, you know, those things started coming back to me. I began to feel, because I was raised right. I wasn't raised amorally. I was raised to know the difference between right and wrong. I began to feel some guilt over that and some shame over the things that I did, the things that I said, you know. It was like I didn't show up to, you know, when I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't show up alone. I had two best buddies that lived with me all the time, guilt and shame. You know, he's brought their best friend, Fear, over to play, too, you know. These guys were kind of like on the rent-to-own plan, you know. They didn't just, like, move in all at once, you know. They just were occasional visitors at the beginning, you know. But then it's like they took a drawer at a time, you know. And by the time I got here, they were permanent residents. And as those things began to pile up on me, I drank to not feel bad. And booze made me not feel bad. It did exactly what I wanted it to do. I did not have to feel bad. Oh, that went away. Get drunk and all that would go away. And then at the very end of my heaviest drinking, the very best I could get out of the bottle was absolutely nothing. The very best I could get out of the bottle was to make everything disappear. You don't think, you don't feel, you don't exist. Everything go away. That was the very best I could get out of the bottle. We call that oblivion. And you know what? I was okay with that. Booze did exactly what I wanted it to do. It made everything go away. Because, well, I'll get into that in a minute. Anyway, my story is I was not the guy that drank a fifth a day for 50 years and then came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I drank. I was what the book describes as a periodic. It says, if when you want to quit drinking you find you can't, or if when you drink you have little or no control over the amount you drink, you might be alcoholic. I'm case number two. Okay? Quitting was not my problem. I quit 100 times. I quit 1,000 times. I could always quit drinking. I could quit a day. I could quit a week. I'm almost sure there was a month in there somewhere, you know? But I can't prove it, but I'm almost sure there was a month in there somewhere. But there was a couple of things, and number one was every time I drank again, it bit me again. Every time I drank again, it got me again. I did not understand. I truly did not understand this, that the first component of being an alcoholic, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic when I got here. I really didn't. Apparently, you catch alcoholism by going to too many meetings of AA, because I was an alcoholic when I got here. Today, I have an extreme bad case of alcoholism, you know, thank God, because you guys can treat that. But, you know, I truly did not understand this very simple thing. We have a very simple way of putting it. It's called the phenomenon of craving. If you want to get technical, that's what the book calls it, is the phenomenon of craving. We very simply put it in Alcoholics Anonymous as this: one is too many, and 1,000 is never enough. And I did not understand this, that once I put alcohol into my body, something happens. So there's a little switch in me that goes, boom. And it doesn't care why I put it in. It doesn't care what form I put it in. It doesn't care if someone prescribed it to me. It doesn't care what I meant to do when I put it in. It doesn't care what my intentions were when I put it in. It just does. My body does what it does when I put alcohol in it. And there's a little switch that goes, boom. And I got to have more of that. I know this because one of the times that I got in trouble was I was going to school right over here in Charlottesville, and I got a letter from my father, and he said, basically, I'm not funding a 4-year party. Get your stuff together, or you can pay for it yourself. And, well, when you're not employed, and you're not employable, and you don't want to work, what do? You run home. You got to patch things up. So I run home to patch things up, and I said, you know, it's all these people I'm hanging out with, you know, and they're bad influence, you know, it's all different now, it's going to be different. You're right, it's time to straighten up and fly right, it's time to be serious, it's going to be different now, which was seemed to be my theme song, it's going to be different now. You know, and I was so, you know, there were many times and many people I told that I wasn't going to drink anymore. There were many times and many people I told I wasn't going to do what I was doing anymore. 9 out of 10 times, 99 out of 100 times, I was telling you this to get you off my back. Just shut up and let me go. Okay? This time I meant it. I was serious. I was really serious. I had too much to live for, you know? So I was so serious that I lasted 2 days. And I lasted 2 days because 2 days later I was out driving with my buddies and they're all shotgunning beers and I'm now the designated driver, of course, because I don't drink anymore. And we're driving along and they said, Dave, it doesn't look like you're having any fun. Of course it wasn't any fun. They're all drinking and I wasn't, you know? So they said, why don't you just have a beer with us? I thought, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, you know, these are my friends. I didn't want to be like antisocial, you know? I haven't had a drink with them, you know? So I had a beer, you know? And 20 minutes later, I was in the back shotgunning beers and doing all the other things that we were doing. And somebody drunker than I was driving. And I woke up the next morning with my regular morning prayer. It's kind of weird, the similarities in the program then and the program now. Just like we have morning prayer and meditation in Alcoholics Anonymous, I said almost the same thing every morning I woke up. Oh, shit. Oh, my God. Not again. You know, followed by the most famous words, which were, oh, well, here we go. You know, I did not understand that I cannot take a drink without taking another drink. Didn't have any clue until I came in here that was the truth, because people would tell me, don't drink so much. Don't get drunk like a maniac, you know? Right. Okay. Did not understand that. But there's another thing. I told you I could quit for a day, a week, or a month, but here's the trick. I could never stay quit. It didn't matter what my intentions were. It didn't matter how much I meant to or why I meant to or what the consequences were going to be or how bad it was last time. Because, you know, a period of time would go by and I would wind up drunk again. Now, here's what would happen. I stop drinking and start showing up and being there when I'm supposed to be there, you know, and I said the family's happy with me, the boss is happy with me, I got a little money in my pocket, the girlfriend's happy with me. Everybody is happy that Dave's not drinking, you know. I'm even getting some slaps on the back, like, attaboy, you're doing fantastic, you're doing great. And then you know what I do? I drink. And you know what happens when I drink? I get drunk. And when I get drunk, I can't tell you any stories of wine coming out of a blackout in Paris or, you know, waking up with the, you know, U.S. women's gymnastic team or anything like that. Nothing. What happens to me when I get drunk is just pretty much sad and tragic things. I mean, sad and tragic things. I mean, the book just so encapsulates it when it uses the phrase pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I'll tell you, if I have to explain pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization to you, I don't know if you need to be here tonight. Because I don't know any drunk that winds up here that does not understand pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So anyway, that's what would happen. Now, everybody understands when things are going bad, someone climbing into the bottle for a little while, and you lose your job, the girl leaves, the dog dies, you know. Everybody understands somebody climbing in the bottle for a while. But they would look at me and go, things were going good. You were doing well. You were doing good. You're on the right track. Why? Why would you do this again? You know? Well, I mean, if you were pressuring me and I had to come up with an answer, I can always come up with an answer. You know, and I'd usually come up with my usual answer, which was, well, it was you. If you'd get off of my back, if you'd stop hounding me like this, if you had to deal with the friends I had, if you had to deal with the family I had, if you had to deal with the job I had, my boss, my whatever, then you'd be doing what I'm doing too. Just leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. I ain't hurting nobody but me. You know what the really sad thing is I believed it when I said that. I believed it. You know what got me? You know what really got me over that? Was going down to the local intergroup office and answering phones. And you answer the calls from the wives and the husbands and the mothers and the daughters and the sons and the fathers. Please help me. What can I do? They won't stop drinking. Please tell me what I can do. Yeah, you answer those calls for about a month. That delusion will be completely smashed. I know now is not the only one I was hurting, but I'm all I think about. So, you know, I would have to come up with an answer, and I'd come up with an answer, and as soon as I came up with the answer, I knew that's what it was. That's what it was. And I had to come up with an answer because I couldn't tell them the truth. Because the truth was, I don't know. I don't know why I did it again. I didn't mean to do it again. I didn't want to do it again. I didn't intend to do it again, but I did it again, and I can't tell you why. But you can't tell them that when they're looking at you, because if you tell them that, they'll put you in an I love me jacket and send you off for observation. So you got to come up with something. So I come up with something, and I'd be doomed to repeat the whole thing over again. Now, I could never figure out why I couldn't stay stopped. But the best description I've ever heard of it was I heard this guy talking, and he said, there's background noise in everybody's head. And the background noise in a normal person's head is like this. And the background noise in an alcoholic's head is like this. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He's going, I can't believe we did this, and why do we do that, and let's do this, and let's do that, and next time we're going to say this, and next time we're going to say that, and why do we do this, and why do we do that, and why do we do that? And I'm going, oh my God. You know? It's just killing me. And I would literally stay sober as long as I could stand it. And when I couldn't stand it anymore, I had to have a break. I could not have explained this to you in a million years when it was happening to me, but it just fits right there. I know none of you ever do this, but I have arguments with people who aren't there. You know, you figure out, you know, and then they're going to say it, and I'm going to say it, and then they're going, oh, yeah. I know none of you ever do that. But I do stuff like that. I got this whole thing going on up here. Luckily, my sponsor made it real simple for me. He said, you know all the committee in your head? I said, yeah. He said, you don't need to get rid of them. You just need to get them sober. Now, I'll tell you what happens eventually. If you stick around here and take some action, all those voices in your head turn into your sponsors. Oh, that's a joy. You know. Program of Honesty, shut up. You know. It helps, though, because then, you know, once that starts happening, your sponsor's entertainment level goes down or not. I can tell you what the favorite thing of any sponsor to hear when his sponsee calls is, guess what I did? So I would stay sober as long as I could stand it, because you know what booze did? It turned off the noise in my head. It turned all that stuff off. And it let me know a little bit of peace for a little bit of time. And you know what? I never lost anything to drink it. I traded it all in. And I'm here to tell you, it was worth it. Even if it was just that 2 seconds before I went over the edge into the blackness. Oh my God. It was worth it. Just to have all that stuff turned off. Now, an ironic thing, in case I skip it later, is I've only found one other thing in my entire life. I've only found one other thing that turns off the noise in my head. And that's what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only other thing I've found that will quiet this thing down and let one day at a time let me know that little bit of peace that I can live free without this thing just torturing me 24/7. My sponsor says, he says, Dave, you know what the difference between a person with a drinking problem and an alcoholic is? By the way, just a hint, if you haven't already experienced this, if you have a sponsor and your sponsor asks you a question, just say, I don't know, because it means they're about to tell you anyway. So, I don't know, Tom. What is the difference? He says, when a person with a drinking problem stops drinking, the problem goes away. When an alcoholic quits drinking, the problem doesn't go away. See? All these people were telling me, all the people that tried to help me were telling me, if you just stop drinking, everything would be okay. If you just stop drinking, everything would be okay. If you stop doing what you're doing, everything would be okay. You know what? I stopped doing it, and it was not okay. And what you were asking me to do was you were asking me to put the bottle away. The only thing that I've ever known that makes me feel halfway sane, like I'm not going to fly into a million pieces at any moment, that my gut is just not tied in knots and those snakes aren't writhing in there. You want me to stop that and live that way, 24/7. I didn't know that's what they were asking me to do. All I knew was, if you threatened my drinking, I came at you like a cornered dog. I mean, I came at you with everything I had. And I didn't even know why. I didn't even know what I was defending. But man, when you threatened my drinking, boom, it just set off an alarm in me like that. And I was going to come after you. How I wound up here in Alcoholics Anonymous was in this state of confusion, was I got into a little bit of trouble. And I was a tough guy, so when I got into trouble, I did what tough guys do. I went to Mom, and that's what we do. And Mom hired a lawyer, and so they got the lawyer to take care of the legal problems, and they said, we know a couple who's sober 1 year in AA, and they'd be willing to talk to you if you want to talk to them. And it's really, if you open this book, which I can't touch because there's a microphone attached to it, which I don't know what the microphone is doing, but if you could open this book and you turn in here, it would tell you, I think it's page 18, it would tell you exactly what they did. They did, I mean, I don't know if they had read this book or they knew they were doing it this way, but they did it exactly the way it's outlined in here. They said, we know a couple who's sober a year and they'd be willing to talk to you if you want to talk to them. And since they were paying the lawyer bills and it would look really bad if I said no, I said, okay. So I went and met my first alcoholics, and that was John and Lisa. And I went over to their place, and John was there, and John was an ex-heroin addict and alcoholic, and the first thing I noted about John was he was smoking unfiltered Camel cigarettes and drinking black coffee, and I thought, jeez, this guy's getting well? Wow. You know? But John did something that nobody had ever done with me. See, all this time, everybody had been telling me about my problem. Dave, you got a problem. Dave, you need to do something about your problem. Dave, when are you going to do something about your problem? Dave, please do something about your problem. He didn't tell me about my problem. He didn't even tell me I was an alcoholic. He didn't tell me anything about me. He sat there and he told me his story. He didn't tell me I was an alcoholic. He told me why he was an alcoholic. And the only problem is, the whole basis of this whole thing that started back in 1935, the entire basis of how Alcoholics Anonymous started, how it's grown, and how it will continue to survive, is one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. Because I'll tell you what happened to me. It takes one to know one. And when you know, you know. And I knew. He took away my last best defense. Because my last best defense always was, you just don't understand. You don't know what it's like, see? And here was a guy sitting across from me, and I swear, within 15, 20 minutes, I knew. This guy had not only walked in my shoes, he'd gone a few miles further down the road, okay? And I could not sit there and tell this guy, you don't know what it's like to be me. It was obvious to both of us. He knew exactly what it was like to be me. So, at the end of that, he asked me three questions. He said, I hear you got a drinking problem. I said, yeah, I'd like to have a beer every once in a while. He said, hey, you got a problem with drugs? Ah, I smoke a joint every once in a while, you know, no big deal. He says, tell me this. He says, are you happy? You don't look happy. And I said, no. I don't even know what happiness is. You know what I remember? He took me to a meeting. You know what I remember about my first meeting? The laughter. You know why? Because I realized it had been a long, long time since I had laughed. Unless I was completely loaded. I mean, just stone cold sober. There was nothing funny going on in my life. It was, you know, I came here and the old timers thought it was pretty funny what was going on in my life, but I didn't think it was nothing funny at all to me that was going on in my life. Nothing entertaining. It was pretty dire stuff, you know. But I remember the laughter because I just realized it was gone from my life. There was no more. You know, I just drank until all the good times were gone, and then I kept drinking after that, you know, like we usually do. And he started taking me to some meetings. It took me about, I did a lot of other stuff besides alcohol. I put all that stuff behind me. About 6 months later, I came back to school up here in Charlottesville, and I never tapered off of drinking. I always tapered on, which went something like, you know, I would be stopped for a period of time, and then, you know, I would have a conversation with myself. You know, I'd be like, hey, you know, dude, things are going pretty good, aren't they? Yeah, everything's going good, man. Everything's up and up now. I go, yeah, well, it was pretty bad for a while. It was really bad for a while. But it's not bad now. No, things are good now. Sure, yeah. A couple wouldn't hurt, would it? No. A couple definitely wouldn't hurt. You know, let's go have a couple. Okay. And I go, have a drink. Sky didn't fall. Cops didn't show up. Nobody called, so it's all good, you know. So I might have two. It would take me less than a week to get ramped right back up to where I was every single time. And I was tapering back on again, and I never stopped completely that entire 6 months. I never picked up a white chip. I never joined because you don't really need to join Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not really an alcoholic. I mean, I could admit to you I had some problems, okay? But no. I'm not an alcoholic. Because you know why I'm not an alcoholic? I'm not an alcoholic because I know what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic drinks out of a brown paper bag and sleeps in a box. And I've never slept in a box. Therefore, I could not be an alcoholic. That's why I would tell you I'm not an alcoholic. So, I'm tapering on. And you know, the last drink I had, January 24th, 1989, was half a can of Coors. And that day I came home at 12:30, nothing in the world bad going, everything actually going very well. And I came home and I popped open that can and I drank half of it at once. And this voice, it wasn't like an audible voice, but it was just a thought that was so loud and so clear that there was no mistaking it. And this thought or voice, whatever it was, said, there's nothing different. And I knew exactly what it meant because that was my battle cry. This winter it's going to be different. This summer it's going to be different. When I get home it's going to be different. When I get back here it's going to be different. When I get a job it's going to be different. When I get a different job it's going to be different. When I get her it's going to be different. It's always somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. I'm trying to arrange. I would tell you, if I can get all this stuff out here worked out, then I won't have to do what I'm doing. I won't have to get loaded like this. I won't have to be a jerk like I am. The reality, I didn't even know what the reality was. The reality was, if I can get all this stuff out here arranged right, then I can drink like I need to drink. Then I'll be free to do what I really want to do, which is get loaded. I mean, people talk about denial all the time. Denial, as I understand, as a sponsor explained it to me, denial is someone who knows the truth but doesn't want to admit it. I didn't have denial. I was delusional. That's different. Delusion is a psychotic thought. You know? What it means to me is, it doesn't mean, you know, the mind. I just told you about the conversation. I mean, don't get me wrong. There were plenty of times that I went out to get loaded, and I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get plowed, as hammered as I could. But there were other times that I had that conversation. I really thought it was going to be okay. And what that means is, when my mind told me it'll be okay this time, in the face of a mountain of evidence to the contrary, all the crap that I've just gone through, all the people that have been mad at me, all the pending charges and stuff, my mind tells me, but this time, it's going to be okay. And you know what? I believed it. I believed it. I didn't say, wow, that's a really bad idea, and that's, you know, this is going to be a lot of trouble. I believed it, and that is the difference. That is delusional. Say, I cannot see the truth. So, I have this half. I never finished that beer. It was half a can of beer. That's sad for an alcoholic's last drink, because I didn't know it would be my last drink for the next 21 years. As a matter of fact, I was 12-stepping a guy. He'd been in and out of our group for a little while, and this was about, geez, I don't know, about 5 years ago now. He calls me and he's living with his brother and he's drinking and he doesn't have a job again. He's like, everything's so bad. And I said, okay, so I left work and I went over there and he's drinking Coronas and we're talking, and finally I had to go, and I said I was going to hook him up with one of the other guys who was going to take him to a meeting because I had another commitment that night, family commitment. And I said, okay, man, what's the deal? You know, you want to go to the meeting or not? And he said, okay, I'll go to the meeting. And I said, okay, but finish your beer first. And he said, why? I said, because I never got to finish mine, and I don't want to do that to you. So finish your beer first, and then we'll go to the meeting. So typical alcoholic, he finished his beer. We get like 200 feet out of the driveway, and he says, oh, I forgot my phone. I got to go get my phone. So I turn around, I park. He goes in the house. He's going 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, comes back out, gets in the car, says, okay, ready. I said, you had another one, didn't you? He said, how'd you know? I said, cause that's what I would have done. We're all alcoholics. That was about 12:30 in the afternoon. I had that half a can of beer, and I never finished it. And I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't know what to do about it. I got scared. I just got scared. The one thing I knew was I was headed, for once in my life, I knew I was headed straight back down the road I just came from. And for once in my life, I didn't want to take the trip. I didn't want to take the trip. I never, ever, ever wanted to go back there. It is a dark and lonely place. And I'm not talking about the circumstances or maximum security prison or anything like that. I'm talking about guilt, shame, fear, and self-loathing. You know, my sponsor tells me my guilt, the measure of my guilt, is what I've done that you found out about. That's what I feel guilty about. The measure of my shame is what I've done that you don't know about. And that is the stuff that eats me from the inside out. And it's been eating me from the inside out a long, long time. And I never, ever in my entire life want to get back to that place. But I didn't know what to do about it. An hour later, I was walking down the street, and I ran into a guy that I partied with the year before. And he had disappeared off the face of the planet. And if you disappeared in the crowd that I ran with, it only meant one of three things. Either you went to jail, you went to treatment, or you were dead. And if he was in jail or dead, I would have known about it. And nobody knew what happened to him. So I made a quick deduction. I grabbed him by the arm as he was passing by, and I said, "Philip, will you take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Sure, Dave." He said, "Tell me where to come and get you. I'll come and get you at 7:30 and take you to a meeting." And I told him, and he did not give me his phone number, by the way, which is significant, and I'll tell you why. Because that was at about 1:30 in the afternoon. By 7:30 that evening, it's amazing what the alcoholic mind can do with 6 hours. Because at 1:30 in the afternoon, I was just scared enough to ask someone to take me to a meeting of AA. By 7:30 that evening, I had figured out that I had grossly overreacted to the situation. Like, whoa, it's not that bad, man, what are we doing? And I swear to this day, if I had his phone number, I would have called him and told him anything in the world to get out of going to that AA meeting. I would have told him I got to walk the dog, I got to do my homework, I got to paint my toenails. I mean, I would have said anything to not have to go, but I didn't have his phone number. He came and got me, and he took me to Monday Night JPA up here in Charlottesville, which is probably still there, which I call my first meeting of AA. Three things happened at that meeting. Number one was I got a white chip. I got a white chip because when they call for white chip, or surrender chip, or whatever they call it these days, when I got a white chip, when they called for them, Philip gave me an elbow in the ribs like this, and that was my signal, so I got a white chip. Now, if you've ever picked up a white chip in AA, and they didn't ask you to get up and say anything, I'm going to tell you why they don't ask you to get up and say anything. I don't know if they were just bored that night or feeling generous or what, but they asked me if I wanted to say something when I picked up my white chip. Now, I don't know anything. Well, actually, I knew everything when I got here to AA. You just didn't care about everything that I knew. You know, I don't know anything today, and I haven't known that much, but there has never been a time in my life that I didn't have something to say. So, what I said when I picked up my white chip, and I'm sorry Randy's not here today, because Randy's usually here. Randy knew me when I came in, when I was brand new, and I always like to see the people who knew me at my best. Keeps me humble. And there are people, you know, in Charlottesville that would confirm this. I got my white chip, and I said, "I am not an alcoholic. This is purely a precautionary measure, just in case, you know." And they said something smarmy, like, "Keep coming back," you know, And then Philip said, "Do you see that guy over there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Ask him to be your sponsor." So I'm feeling, "Yeah, will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Yeah. Do you have a big book?" "No." "Do you have $5? "No." I did, but I wasn't going to pay anything to be here. I didn't even want to be here. I wasn't going to be here longer than 6 months. I didn't invest any money in this thing, right? So he bought me my first big book and gave me a ride home. Carted me to meetings for about a week every night. I thought that was a little excessive. To go every day. I mean, maybe if you had a really bad case or something, you know, but I was an alcoholic, not like these people, you know. And honestly, what I thought was I'd put all the other party favors aside, and I thought, booze, no problem. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not having any problem whatsoever quitting. Hell, I've quit before. I'm not going to have any problem quitting booze. And so I went for 30 days, and I went to meetings. I don't know how many meetings I went to. I went to some meetings. I didn't go every day. But I went to some, you know, and I did anything, you know, I did the newcomer dance. I took 3 cigarette breaks, 5 trips to the coffee pot, counted the holes in the ceiling, figured out which newcomer girl I wanted to talk to after the meeting. You know, do anything except listen to what's going on, because you don't really need to listen if you're not really an alcoholic. So 30 days came up, and I went to get my 30-day chip, picked up the blue chip, and I'll never forget, I went up and gave Big Tom H. gave me a hug and said, "Congratulations on your 30 days. And I looked at him in the eyes, and I said, "I'm going to drink." Which was news to me. I didn't know that. But if I had known that, I certainly wouldn't have told him. But all of a sudden, it came down on me. I was thirsty. I mean, oh my God, it had been 30 days. I was dying, and I knew all of a sudden, because, you know, I was really bad at a lot of things when I was drinking, but I was really, really good at 2 things. Number one, I was really, really good at just getting by. I mean, just barely getting by, you know, even if I had to leave a little skin behind. and I was really a champion plan comer upper with her. You know, I mean, just you put me in a jam. I remember, you know, I know this never happened to any of you, you know, but I get in a jam and I get in trouble. My mind would go 5,000 miles an hour, and I literally would think, if I can just get two beers, I know I can figure this thing out. I know I can, and that's exactly what would happen. I get a couple beers, and I figure this thing out, and I come up with a champion plan. And my plan the night that I picked up my 30-day chip was to go get my chip at the AA meeting and meet the blonde at the keg party afterwards, you know? And I would tell you, oh, I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to drink ginger ale. And, man, those words came out of my lips, and I knew what was going down tonight. I needed it really bad. So, of course, when I told him I'm going to drink, I thought, oh, my God. I thought, no, I wish I wouldn't have done that, because now I'm going to have to listen to the whole thing, you know. Don't give up, or don't leave before the miracle happens. You got so much to live for. You got to hang in there, blah, 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 blah. And I just didn't think I could take it if they went into all this stuff. He didn't say any of that. He looked me back in the eye and he said, no, you're not. You're coming with us. Not sure what step that is, but that's what he said. And since, actually in my group, that is sort of the first step. We boil it down to shut up and get in the car. So he was about this much wider and this much taller than me, and I found my first higher power. And I said, the smartest thing, that up to and including tonight, the smartest thing I've ever said in Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, okay. Okay. And I stiffed the blonde at the keg party, and I went with them, and we got some pizza and rented a couple of movies and watched those, and I went home and I went to bed, and when I woke up the next morning, I was still sober. And ironically enough, I have just told you the story of my recovery in AA. Because I didn't realize it until a long time later. But what happened that night was I was going to drink. And I took direction from a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of my own plan, because I did have a plan. And I put my own plan aside. And I took direction from one of you guys. And I stayed sober when I knew I was going to get drunk. And that is the story of my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, is putting my plan aside for a little while and taking a little direction from you guys. Because I'll tell you this, I haven't counted them lately, but I've had more than one sponsor in AA. And I'm incredibly grateful to every single one of them for everything they've done. But every sponsor I've had, and every one of them has given me something a little bit different, but every single one of them has had one thing in common. And that is, when I call them and I present them with something or tell them what's going on, they give me a suggestion. You can call it direction, suggestion, whatever you want. They tell me, this is what you're going to do. Every single one of them, when they give me a direction, I always have the same thought, up to and including last week when I called my sponsor. They say, do this, and my mind says, that ain't going to work. Definitely not going to work. As a matter of fact, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, you know. And I've learned, my sponsor gave me the key to staying in AA. Because you think, it's everybody here knows how hard it is to get to AA. I don't have to explain that to you. You know what's harder than getting to AA? Staying in AA. Because if staying in AA was less hard than getting to AA, AA wouldn't have 3 million members. We'd have 300 million members. The average amount of sobriety in AA worldwide wouldn't be 3.5 years. It'd be 30 years. But it's not. Because it's harder to stay here than it is to get here. But my sponsor gave me the key to staying. And it's summed up in one word. Okay. Because when my mind says, that's not going to work, I say, okay. Here's why. I'm a big why guy. I gotta have a reason, you know. My mind goes, why should I do that? You know, I got to have a reason. Here's my reason. Tom's been my sponsor for about 12 years now. So I figured out that I can't prove him wrong unless I actually do what it is he suggests that I do. Right? Otherwise, I'm just a whiner. Right? But if I do it and it doesn't work, then I can tell him to go jump off a bridge. Then I can tell him he's full of it. So for the past 12 years, I have been in the consistent and constant process of trying to prove my sponsor wrong. And I haven't succeeded yet, but my life has improved dramatically in the process of trying to prove him wrong. So, don't know if it makes sense to anybody else, but I go with it because it worked for me. He's also told me what the most deadly words in Alcoholics Anonymous are. The most deadly words are, yeah, but. Yeah, but. I found out more deadly words for me are, I know, I know. See, sponsors speak drunk. They know that when I say I know, it means you're right, but I ain't going to do anything about it. That's what I know means. So, I know that, you know, this is the part where I should say, and then I got with my sponsor and we sat down and we went through the book and the steps and I got caught on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous and I got recovered in AA. Except, this is not that part. I know none of you ever did this. But it's kind of funny because when I was out there drinking and somebody said, here, drink this. I said, okay. They said, here, smoke one of these. I said, okay. They said, here, take a couple of these. I said, okay. What do those do to you? Yeah? I get here at Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys say, get a home group, get a sponsor, and do the steps. And I went, whoa! Whoa! I don't want to rush into anything here. I'm making rash decisions. I think I need to check this thing out first, which is weird because rash decisions is about the only kind of decisions I've ever made in my life. Yet, I get here and I'm going to err on the side of safety. So, I had to spend the next 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous learning that I am an alcoholic, that my problem is not booze. My problem is another little thing called alcoholism, and that is a whole different animal. See, I find out that alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. That's what I treated my alcoholism with, and you know what? It worked like a champ for a long time. But then the thing that was a solution became a problem. The booze became a problem, and that's what put me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took the booze away, and guess what? When I took the booze away, there was alcoholism, right there. I am a living testament that everybody in AA is not getting well. I can say that because I was one of them. Best way I can describe it is, ladies, I was the one that your sponsor said, stay away from him. Don't go near him. That was me. I was that guy. So to make a long story short, when I was 3 years sober, I was living in Richmond, and I went to a meeting. A lot of things happened around that time I don't have time to go into. But I went to a meeting one day, and I heard a guy talk about a solution. I'm not saying nobody ever talked about a solution before. I'm saying I heard him talk about a solution. And he had shiny eyes, you know. And there was something about his eyes. He really believed what he was telling me. Because you can't BS a BSer. And we're here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the best BSers in the world, you know. So it ain't going to fly. But this guy was genuine. And he believed what he was saying. And I wanted what he had. So he sat down. And we went through the big book. And we went through the steps, to make a long story short. And my life didn't change, but I changed. For once in my life, best way I can describe it, for once in my life, I had the same job, lived in the same place, had the same family, same everything, except for once in my life, I wanted what I had. I wasn't thinking about what I should have, or I shouldn't be here, or be with this person, I should have this, I should have that, I wish I had this, I wish I had that. All that went away, and I was perfectly fine, right where I was, right with what I had. And that had never, ever happened to me before. Ever. And everything got quiet in my head. And I called my sponsor and said, I think I'm going crazy. He said, why? What's going on in your head? I said, nothing. He said, welcome. That's called serenity. Yeah? Like, weird. So, I did that. My job was to carry the message to others, and I graduated school, and we're in the middle of a recession, and I couldn't get a job to save my life with the degree that I had. But there was one group of people that wanted me, and they were a volunteer aid organization. So I figured, what the heck, my job's to help out, so good time to do it. So I went to Ecuador, South America for a year and a half, and I lived in a little town of 300 people. Found an AA group in the next town down. They had six meetings. There was like eight of us. We had six meetings a week. We could tell, a month was out, any of us could have told anybody else a story, you know, but we stayed sober together. I was an active participant in that group, Grupo Siempre Unidos de Latacunga, Ecuador. There were no English-speaking meetings at all, so I learned Spanish. As a matter of fact, all the other volunteers were impressed. How did you learn Spanish so well? Well, you know what? I went to a lot of AA meetings, and they were all Spanish-speaking meetings. So I learned a lot of Spanish. Please don't quiz me afterwards. It's been a long time. But I was an active member of AA. And to tell you how good the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works, a small town in South America is pretty much just like a small town in America. Every social event revolves around drinking. And they drink rum. And they drink a lot of rum. A whole lot of rum, you know? And I did not, for a year and a half, I never had the compulsion to drink. Never once while I was there. It never bothered. It was, for once, you know, during this process, I woke up and I realized I hadn't thought about drinking in a long time. It's just gone. And this is what I found out for the past 21 years is when I practice the solution that you guys have given me, the problem goes away. I've also found out, because I have not done this thing perfectly, I've also found out that when I stop practicing the solution that you guys have given me, the problem comes back. And it's pissed. It really comes back, and it comes back with a vengeance, you know. But the beautiful thing is, every time I start practicing it again, it works, you know. And I just kind of, I don't know, my tolerance for pain has gone down or what, but, you know, what an early sobriety was like this, you know, I'm just starting to flatline a little bit, you know. Every once in a while I get a hiccup, you know. But life has gotten smooth. Maybe not the outside things. I mean, I've been through, but gosh, what I've experienced in sobriety. I've been overseas. I've had several jobs of my own choosing. I've gotten married. I've had kids. I've gotten divorced now. You know, I've had all these experiences through sobriety, and I'm grateful for every one of them. There are some that I would choose not to redo, but I would not want to do them again. But I am grateful that I had them and that I have that experience. And I've got two wonderful children. And I have a relationship with a God today. I had one when I was 11 years old. I wasn't, you know, fighting everybody to go to the church. I had a relationship with a God of my understanding. I didn't understand what happened was when I took a drink, I got a new God. That's literally what happened. I took a drink and I had a new God because I would worship it and I was willing to go to any lengths for it. You know, and you guys gave me a relationship with my Creator again. Literally, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. You know what I believed for all those years? I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I took the first step when I was 3 years sober, sitting down with a sponsor and opening that big book and finding out what an alcoholic is. And up until that point, what I really believed was, if you took a knife and you slipped me from my Adam's apple to my belly button, you opened me up, you'd find nothing but black, dead, dry rot inside. That was just damaged goods. I was just no good. I wasn't sure if God wanted somebody like that back. That's the way I looked at it. Wanted somebody back. See? I found out in AA all I had to do was give God a shot. And you know what? Having kids has been so wonderful because kids are kid-like in a lot of ways. But they're also God-like in a lot of ways. You know? You know, I have a reasonable assurance today that my kids love me. I can say that because I get a card on Father's Day. And they tell me they love me, and they give me a present on Christmas, and it's not Old Spice. So I have, you know, a reasonable assurance that they love me. But you know why my kids love me? They don't care that I get asked to come to Madison, Virginia to speak. They don't care what my home group is. They don't care how many people I sponsor. They don't care how many years I've been sober. They've never seen me drink. They don't care what I do for a living. They don't care about what my job is. They don't care how much money I make, although they're almost teenagers, and they will very shortly care how much money I make. Not quite yet, you know. They don't care about any of that stuff. They don't care what kind of car I drive. They don't care about any of that stuff. You know why they love me? They love me because I'm their dad. Period. I'm not the best dad in the world. I'm not the worst dad in the world. They just love me just because I'm their dad. And today I understand that my God loves me, and I know why my God loves me. Because I'm his kid. Period. End of story. Not because I'm a good kid. Not because I'm a bad kid. Get this. Not because I'm sober. My friend Bill up in New York, Pennsylvania is always fond of saying, God doesn't care whether I'm drunk or sober. God just cares. Period. And I found out that God loves me. And what was amazing to me was, he doesn't love me any more the day after I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous than he loved me the day before I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he gave us the greatest gift in the world. Free will. A God that could make me do anything, make me say anything, make me be anything, gave me the right to choose. That impresses me. And so I choose God because, I'll end with this, I found out everything in my life is temporary. everything. It's not even real. Parents. Parents grow up. They get old. They die. You know, you get married, you get divorced. Even kids, they're born, they grow up. They're going to go on and get their own lives, you know. Money, sometimes you got it, sometimes you don't. Everybody's finding that out these days. You know, jobs come and go. All this stuff comes and goes. There's only two things I've found that stay. One is the problem. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That ain't going away. The other one is God. God's always been there. God will always be there. So I choose God to make Him the central focus thing in my life, because He's the one thing besides the problem that's never gone anywhere and never going anywhere. Thanks again for asking me to come and speak, though.